Welcome to the first Tennis Worthy podcast of 2026. I'm Patrick McEnroe, and all of us at the International Tennis Hall of Fame would like to wish you a very happy and healthy new year. Now, the tennis world is gathering in Australia for a series of events leading up to the first Grand Slam tournament of the year, the Australian Open. The Australian Open dates from 1905. Originally, it was the Australasian Championships. Then in 1927, it became the Australian Championships. And since January 1969, it's been the Australian Open. Our Chris Bowers looks at how both the year's first major and Australian tennis have developed into what they are today.
Following its launch in the 1870s, the modern form of tennis took root very early in Australia and New Zealand, but the distance both the Australasians and the rest of the tennis-playing world had to travel meant that for many years, the tournament we now know as the Australian Open had a tough time feeling connected with the tennis world in Europe and the Americas. There was also a problem of population. While the Australians were a very sporty nation, there weren't a lot of them. Thelma Coyne Long, who dominated Australian tennis before and after the Second World War, says the way she picked up tennis was typical for the 1920s.
In those days, we had a small population in Australia. I think the whole of Australia would have only been a population of about 7 million. And here in Sydney, we had about 35,000 metropolitan players playing tennis because our living quarters usually were quite a large house. Everyone wanted a home and a house to live in. And there was always quite a big backyard. And so many of these backyards were filled with tennis courts. And so people played tennis. And so this is how I came to be interested in the game. Where I lived, there was a laneway and other places had these tennis courts in the backyards. In fact, I used to watch people play tennis. And I think from watching them playing tennis is how I learned the basics of the game, even, say, at 11 or 12 years of age. I think I won my first title, if you call it that, at the age of 12. And that was the B-grade ladies singles championship of the Eastern Suburbs District. And it was rather incredible that everybody was interested in the game of tennis.
The vehicle that most helped to establish Australia's tennis tradition and indirectly help build up the Australian Open was the Davis Cup. Tennis's oldest team competition played a major role in popularising tennis in Australia and with it Australia's premier tournament. The legendary Australian Davis Cup captain, Harry Hopman, interviewed in 1978, said a big problem when he started out was that tennis just wasn't that well known in Australia.
It was knowledgeable to people like myself who were keen on ball games or keen on sport. I knew that Australia competed in the Davis Cup. The Davis Cup was the be-all and end-all for most people in Australia. Tennis was not a game of the people. It was a game of the folk who were wealthy enough to lay a court of their own. It was not till, that was 1919, it was not till about 1930 that tennis started to become a people's game, where one court was laid for a club was formed, or four courts were laid and a club was formed, or clubs got started to become, the few clubs there were began to grow and get up to numbers of 65 courts at White City, Sydney, where the Davis Cup was played, let's say in 1954, and other years, of course. There, at that time, 54, there were probably 65 courts in the White City courts in Sydney.
Harry Hopman captained Australia's Davis Cup teams from 1938 to 1969, during which his 22 campaigns netted the Aussies the title 16 times. Some of the great Davis Cup matches were played in the venues that hosted the Australian Championships. Until the 1960s, the tournament was played on a rotating basis in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane and Adelaide. Early attempts to take it to Perth had founded on few Australians being willing to travel over 3,000 kilometres, that's 2,000 miles, from east coast to west. The young John Newcombe, a future Davis Cup and Australian Open champion, has memories from age 10 of following the 1954 Davis Cup final between Australia and the USA at Sydney's White City Stadium.
Well, the 1954 Davis Cup in Sydney, world record crowd at that time, 26,000 people. And the year before, they'd played at Kooyong in Melbourne, the Davis Cup final against the Americans. And for 4 days, was one day of rain, so for 4 days, I crouched by the radio in our house in Sydney. I was 9 years of age then and listened to every ball. So when I went to the 54 Davis Cup finals, and Harry Hopman had heard about the, I guess, from someone about to, and he invited me out to have a practice with the team, and my parents took me out there, and I had a hit for about 15 minutes with Merv Rose, and then, you know, went to the match with my dad to watch. So little things like that, they whet the appetite of a young player, and I was a pretty good cricketer as well, you know, but I was steered towards the tennis was what I wanted to do, and Davis Cup was what I wanted to do.
That image of Newcombe crouching by his radio was a common one. With Australia so far from the centres of gravity of world sport, and many Australians a long way from each other, the radio proved a strong basis for Aussies who were into tennis to follow it. For the players who wanted to make an impression in the prestigious but still amateur tournaments like Wimbledon, Roland Garros and the US Nationals, it meant a long time on the road. Ken Rosewall recalled in 2009 the reality of being a top-level Australian tennis player.
Well, the travel is always difficult because when you live in the Southern Hemisphere, you have to travel to compete. You know, even the earlier amateur tennis days, you're still outside of Australia for 6 or 7 months of the year playing tournaments in the Northern Hemisphere. So Australians, you know, had to be prepared to travel and be away from your home or families or whatever in those days. In any events, you know, the regular tournaments or the Davis Cup, you know, a lot of travel was involved and it meant a lot of time being away from your country.
And yet those long periods on the road engendered a tremendous solidarity among the travelling Australian players. They'd often have dinner together, and while they might have to compete against each other the next day, they were always supportive when one was having a hard time. That bunker mentality started back home in Harry Hopman's training sessions, and the great disciplinarian was even happy to bring in Australia's leading female player, Margaret Smith, or Margaret Court, as the 24 times Grand Slam singles champion recalled in 2020.
Well, I think I was very fortunate at a very young age being allowed to come in and train with the Davis Cup team with Harry Hopman. I was only, you know, 16, 17 back in those times and got to know those guys, and they would laugh. They would see Harry Hopman working me, that, you know, the doing drop volleys and making me run in and then over my head and run back. And by the time you're finished, you were lying on the ground, and then he'd say to Roy Emerson and I, now go for a 5 mile run. And Hoppy knew I was a workhorse too, just like Emo and that. So, you know, I was sort of like the sister, and I got on with them. And I think probably they took me under their wing, and they'd allow me play with them and hit with me. And, you know, I'd stand behind the court a bit younger than some of them, and they'd see me looking through the back of the tennis fence, looking at them, and they'd say, come on, Smithy, you want to come and have a hit? And then, you know, it was Hoppy who said, come on. And then I started to train with them, and I loved that. And I think that helped me so much in the early years with my fitness and tennis.
Despite being amateurs, Australia's players were governed by their national federation, the Lawn Tennis Association of Australia, today Tennis Australia. They were obliged to be home during the Australian tennis season, or they'd lose the funding that was essential to them being able to afford going overseas. And then they'd often be away for 6 or 7 months because they couldn't just nip home the way they can now. And they were aware that the status of tennis in Australia depended on them winning the biggest tournaments overseas, notably Wimbledon. Two of the great Australian champions, Rod Laver and Roy Emerson, talk about the dreams and pressures of winning Wimbledon. Laver first.
Probably when I was around 13, 14, and, you know, when Wimbledon was on, maybe we were watching or listening to the coverage from the BBC you know, with Fred Perry being the MC of the whole program over there in England. And that gave me the thought that there's a Wimbledon. And then, you know, when you go beyond that, Davis Cup was always something that was, because it was being won by Australians all the time. You know, when you're out and you've got your radio and when you can pick up the coverage, down in Sydney or Melbourne, we always enjoyed listening to all the coverage. So I would imagine that's when it hit me that I'd like to be able to play at Wimbledon or represent Australia in Davis Cup.
Wimbledon was the big tournament back with all the amateur players, and when I won it for the first time in 1964, that was a big one. And I didn't know, I was playing against my friend Fred Stolle. When I had match point, I'm serving for the match, I didn't know whether I could open my fingers when I tossed the ball up. I was pretty nervous, and I said, don't worry, it's not Wimbledon, it's Wagga Wagga in Australia. You know, throw the ball up and hit it. But every player wanted to win Wimbledon, and, you know, everyone wanted to win their own national championship, and everybody wanted to play Davis Cup. But Wimbledon was the one at that stage.
With the first overseas players only flying to Australia in 1946, airfares still proving too expensive for most players and their national associations, and the boats from Europe taking up to 6 weeks, it was little wonder that the Australian Championship struggled to get all the world's top players. Some made the trip in some years, but it was often impractical and unaffordable for many to travel to Melbourne, Sydney, Adelaide or Brisbane. By 1972, the crowds in Melbourne were so much better than elsewhere that the Kooyong Club in the city's eastern suburbs became the permanent venue for the Australian Open. Although the growth in affordable airfares meant more of the top players made the trip, the tournament still struggled, and it was clear that Kooyong wasn't a viable venue for the long term. In 1984, when Tennis Australia's president, Brian Tobin, suggested to the Premier of Victoria, John Kane, the idea of a publicly funded new facility with retractable roof in the centre of Melbourne, it found fertile ground. Steve Wood is a former player who went on to become chief executive of Tennis Australia.
The foresight for that was put forward by the administrators at the time, right back with Brian Tobin, Jeff Pollard. The tennis industry at that time lobbied the government heavily to make this pitch to them to invest. John Kane saw that foresight in the middle of one of the worst downturns in economic times for the Victorian economy. He still made the investment in what we now know as Rod Laver Arena, and that proved to be the masterstroke that got the Australian Open up and running.
The new facility, known then as Flinders Park, now Melbourne Park, with the Rod Laver Arena as its jewel in the crown, opened in 1988, which marks the start of the modern era of the Australian Open. And there's been a neat payback to the Davis Cup, as the Rod Laver Arena has hosted several big Davis Cup showdowns, including two finals on makeshift grass. When Leighton Hewitt beat Roger Federer from two sets down to see Australia through to the 2003 Davis Cup final, he said he'd been motivated by Australia's tennis tradition, notably its Davis Cup triumph at Kooyong over Sweden in 1986.
At one stage, I was 2 points away from losing the match. You know, I felt like the longer the match went, it played into my favour as well, fitness-wise, and then also just using the crowd to get behind me as the match went on. And I have so many memories, though, of Pat Cash coming back and beating me, Mikhail Pernforce in 86 in the Davis Cup final. I've watched that match, I don't know, over 100 times at Kooyong there on the grass court. And for me, I just had visions of that. That's all I wanted to do one day was do that. And this was my version and my opportunity to be able to do it. And after I won the third set, I honestly believed I was going to win that match.
Since the move to Melbourne Park, the Australian Grand Slam champions include Patrick Rafter, Leighton Hewitt and numerous doubles players. But no Australian had won a singles title at the new venue until Ash Barty, who became the first Aussie singles champion on home soil for 44 years when she won in 2022. Many had lamented the passing of the grass and leaving the private members club at Kooyong. But even traditionalists like Ken Rosewall recognise that the move enabled Australia's slam to keep pace with its major partners.
certainly the Australian Open has become such a big event because of the international influx of players and the, you know, the performance of the European players and how it's improved in the years of open tennis, and since maybe the tennis being back in the Olympics and the funding for tennis in the so-called third world countries has been improved.
Rose Wall mentioned the Olympics there, and in a way the Olympics bring the Australian tennis story full circle. If the growth of Australian tennis originally required the International Davis Cup competition to drive it, the Olympics proved to be the ground on which Australia's tennis achievements became recognised beyond its tennis community. By the time of the Atlanta Olympics in 1996, the Aussie doubles pair of Todd Woodbridge and Mark Woodford had won the Australian Open, US Open and Wimbledon titles. But it took them winning the Olympic gold for their country's sporting community to fully embrace them, as Woodford explains.
We were one of 9 gold medalists for Australia that year. And like any other country, but in Australia, we celebrate our athletes who win a gold medal. And you know, to have the basketball team turn up and to have the volleyball girls come and sit in the stands and, you know, each night, you know, going back into the village and people that we knew of or we had read about or seen on TV as we had grown up were coming up to us. We were surprised they knew about the Woodies and, you know, you guys are going for gold and, you know, a couple more matches and, you know, to walk back into the village with our gold medal was just wild. So I think, you know, those moments of, because we were part of a team, to share it with a team, I'd like to believe it's just that much more special.
That Olympic gold came in 1996, the year that the same ranking points were awarded for the Australian Open as were awarded at the other 3 Grand Slam tournaments. Until then, the lower prize money paid in Australia was reflected in lower ranking points. But in a new and expanding venue, the Australian Open had finally arrived. 30 years on, we go into 2026 with the Australian Open now the best attended of the 4 majors, having welcomed 1.2 million people through its gates in 2025. Melbourne may still be a considerable distance from the main tennis centres of the world, but the Australian Open now enjoys parity among its peers.
That was Chris Bowers tracing the rise of Australian tennis and the Australian Open. And our thanks as well to Joel Drucker for a lot of research that went into that brief history. Chris and I will be in Melbourne for the peak of the Australian Summer of Tennis. We'll have much more interviews and discussions for you over the next month. And don't forget that all the interviews, discussions, and other podcasts we've done are always available at tennisfame.com/podcast. So check out past podcasts and let your friends know that there are some great listens in our archive. The Tennis Worthy Podcast is brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm Patrick McEnroe, proud to be the president of the Hall of Fame. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon.